under any circumstances would consider Biggie to be a compliment to everybody would consider Biggie to be a derogatory nickname. Absolutely, absolutely prohibited. And any type of, again, I'm sure that you can all think of plenty of examples for all of these, for nickname, for even more categories, but I'm just picking a few just to get a bearing on the just get a handle on the subject. Anything you say to upset somebody, right, that anything that is very common to tell somebody who looks nervous, right? Gee, I see you look nervous about something.
No, I don't. I'm not.
Right? No, I think you're pretty nervous. Maybe a tranquilizer.
No, I don't.
What are you upsetting for? And embarrassment. Now, embarrassment is, the Gemara says that a person should throw himself into a flaming furnace rather than embarrass somebody in public. Right? A person should rather allow himself to be burnt to death. Right? The source for this in the Torah is that when Yehuda, in the story of Yehuda, Yehuda had two sons. Now, each one of his sons was married to a woman named Tamar. Each one of these sons died. Er was the first son, and Onan was the second son. Er and Onan, it's called Onanism to this day. They both sinned by wasting their seed, and both of them, God put them to death prematurely. Now, Yehuda had another son, and his daughter-in-law, Tamar, was told to wait until the third son became old enough to marry her. He was a minor at the time. In the meantime, she dressed herself up as a prostitute, and she seduced Yehuda, her former father-in-law. Yehuda didn't recognize her, because when the Gemara says that when she was his daughter-in-law, he had never seen what she looked like because she was so tsinuistic, right? She always kept her face covered. She never saw her. So he didn't know that this was his daughter-in-law, and he impregnated her. 3 months later, at 3 months, a woman begins to show. His daughter-in-law, Tamar, began showing, and they held a court, and they decided that since she was bonded to his third son, she was waiting for the third son, she was actually bonded to him, she's gone out and got herself pregnant through somebody else, she deserves to be put to death, right? It's a form of immorality. The sentence, the death sentence, was to be burnt. When Yehuda had the relationship with her, he didn't have any money, he gave her three personal possessions, his walking stick and a couple of other things that he had given her, his signet ring, which he had given her as a pledge, which he'll redeem for money later. And he had given this to her as payment. When she was being taken out to be burnt to death, right, now obviously she was innocent because her father-in-law had the right to impregnate her, that was the form of Yibum, that was the form of the next of kin impregnating her. When she was being taken out to be executed, rather than say, he's the one who impregnated me and embarrassed him publicly, all she would say is, whoever these things belong to is the one that's impregnated me. And she would not say she was willing to go to her death if Yehuda would not at that moment have stepped up and said, yes, it is my possessions that she has. I am the guilty party. I'm the one who has impregnated her. Since she did not say that, right, she was willing to go to the death. On that, the Gemara makes the comment that a person, rather than embarrass someone publicly, a person should allow themselves to be thrown into a flame. Right? Now, there are halachic authorities that say that's literal. There are halachic authorities that say it's not only an emphasis of the severity of embarrassing somebody publicly, there are halachic authorities that say that literally, the same way you must give up your life for the three cardinal sins, person must give up their life for embarrassing somebody in public. Why is that? Because embarrassment is considered tantamount to murder. When you embarrass somebody, it's considered tantamount to murder. Why is that? What happens to the person's face when they become embarrassed? Right? They turn red. Before they turn red, their face turns white. All of the blood drains from their face, and then a person, probably everybody here at one point has been embarrassed, right? Everybody's been embarrassed in public, right? At a certain point, when the embarrassment hits, then that first moment of embarrassment, the blood drains from a person's face, the person turns completely white, and then the blood rushes back in. And that's why a person turns crimson, from the blood rushing back into the face. That moment of the draining of a person's blood from his face is considered equal to having spilled his blood. And that's why embarrassment is considered tantamount to murder. And that's why they're the same way that you are not allowed to, you must give up your life rather than murder somebody. A person must give up their life rather than embarrass somebody. For slightest, to embarrass somebody in public, person forfeits his portion in the world to come. Therefore, a person certainly has to be careful. There are two forms of embarrassment. You can embarrass somebody in an overt way, simply by insulting them or saying something about them, or you can embarrass somebody in a much more subtle way. This happens very often. If somebody walks up to you, you're standing with a group of people, and somebody walks up to you and says, "Hi, remember me?" No, not really, no. You're standing in front of a group, and it turns out that he was waving to you from across the field at Wrigley Field many years ago at a baseball game, right? And he says, "Do you remember me?" Right? Now you're standing in front of a group of people, and you are embarrassed. Now, he didn't intend to embarrass you, but he still has an obligation to ask for forgiveness because of the pain that he caused. These are all harmful possibilities with misusing the power of speech. Any questions up until now? Stephen?
In the case of embarrassment, is the exclusion made for an idol worship? For example, you are approached by idol worshippers.
Ha ha, you are an idol worshipper, right? Embarrassment.
Yeah, for example, suppose.
You don't have to be concerned for his feelings.
No, but suppose he tries to get involved in the discussion in something like that. So.
An idol worshipper? Yeah. Specifically, an idol worshipper, you don't have any obligation to be concerned with his feelings. He's trying to entice you into idol worship.
Right.
In the time of the Beis Hamikdash, if somebody was accused of trying to bring other people, influence other people to worship idols, he was punishable by death. Right? Not only that, whereas in most cases the court tries to find some type of merit for him, somebody who was inciting other people to idol worship, they wouldn't look for any type of merit for such a person. Not only that, it was the only situation where entrapment was halachically legal. You could put two people. Somebody comes up to you and says, "You know what, I'd like you to come worship idols with me." You can say to him, "Do you mind repeating?" Plant two witnesses behind the wall, and then you walk over him and say, "Do you mind repeating what you said to me earlier?" And he says, "Would you like to go worship idols with me?" The witnesses could then spring out, take him to Beis Din, and they would execute him.
But what if you just rebuke him, and that's a thought isn't there?
So you should know that rebuke in general, what you're asking now is a very important question, because anytime you rebuke somebody, the same verse that says you've got an obligation to rebuke your fellow man, the same verse says that you must be very careful not to cause him any pain or embarrassment. Right? If you see somebody transgressing, so there are certain halachic parameters of when you have the obligation to rebuke somebody and when you don't. If you see somebody rebuking, when we're speaking about the laws of honoring parents, you see your father rebuking or transgressing, right? You have an obligation to rebuke. Rebuke does not necessarily mean you have to shout at somebody. Rebuke simply means to point out the correct way of doing things, right? The halacha is that although you have to rebuke people, you are not allowed to rebuke in such a way that you are going to hurt their feelings. Right? And if you do that, then you don't get the mitzvah for correcting them. You get the avera for hurting their feelings. Okay, Keith?
What about as far as missionaries go?
Missionaries?
Yeah.
As far as what?
As far as serving the dinner, do you have to stand there for 15 minutes while they give you a
servant? No, you don't have to stand politely while they give you a servant. I actually had a couple of missionaries knocked on the door of my in-laws' house. I was in America a few years ago, and a couple of missionaries knocked on the door, and my wife answered the door, so she called me over. He said, "No, we'd like to talk, maybe you could talk to these people." So they came in, and I don't know what they were getting out, books, flowers, whatever it was. They said that, so we sat down. I said, "Hi, hello," and she said, "Can I ask you a question?" "Yeah, go ahead. Do you believe in the kingdom of heaven?" I said to her, "Well, we do. I don't think it's the same kingdom you believe in. You believe in the kingdom of heaven, right?" We had a nice, pleasant conversation. Now, if it's a missionary that's becoming abusive, right, or if it's a missionary that's in a place where the missionary is a danger, downtown Yerushalayim, and a missionary starts up, you don't have any obligation to be polite, and just walk away. I wouldn't suggest engaging in an argument with them. You're not going to get very far. They've been programmed very often, and chances are they know a lot more about the subject matter than you do. You're not allowed to use any type of physical abuse, right? Sometimes guys will come up and say, "We go down and beat up missionaries." right? No, you cannot go downtown and beat up missionaries. Right? If you go downtown and beat up missionaries, you will be arrested, right? So no, you cannot beat up missionaries. It is not your job to go beating up missionaries. And in spite of the fact that it brings out certain, evokes certain emotional responses, right, you are not allowed to do such a thing. They had in O'Hare Airport in Chicago, they had whenever you would get off the plane, you'd be accosted by missionaries, right? They had these people around the airports were constantly going, "Hello, my name is Rainbow. Would you like to find out about it?" And they stuff a book in your face or whatever, a flower or a book. So finally somebody came up with an idea. They you know these little clickers? They're these little clickers. The little kids play click, 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 and the missionaries would come around. And they would, you know, the minute the missionary would open their mouth, they'd start clicking, click, 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 and the missionary would leave. So eventually they made a rule in O'Hare Airport that the missionaries are not allowed around the airport. They roped off an area for them, right? And they had to stand in this roped-off area. And then the people are getting off the planes, right? And the missionary, "Hey, would you like to be here?" You know, they're standing from behind the rope, right? So Mike Royko, I think, wrote once about a missionary came running up the policeman. And this missionary said to the policeman, "You know, I was behind a roped-off area, and this guy came over to me and started hassling me." And the policeman said, "Really?" Click, 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 click. Click the whole way. But as far as hurting their feelings, you do not have to worry about. Don't get involved in any type of argument. Don't get involved in any type of debate, because all that's going to happen is a waste of your time. You're not going to change them in any way, shape, or form. And it's in general, it's a good policy in life to be respectful of everybody, right? You don't get very far being disrespectful. Yeah?
Are there any circumstances under which you are permitted to reference someone else's background? To reference someone else's background.
To check someone else's background?
No, to reference it. For example, under any circumstances, would you be permitted to tell a third party that someone else was convert to Judaism?
Absolutely. If somebody is looking for the classic, and we're going to get to the laws of Lashon Hara, when Lashon Hara is permissible. If somebody is looking for, is asking you a question for a beneficial purpose. Somebody wants to know about their about a young man. They're looking for somebody to marry his daughter, right? So like the guy in the yeshiva, I heard this, but suggested for a shit up. Do you know this guy? I said, "Well, yeah, actually, he's done time with me in the penitentiary for 2 years." But a future father-in-law might want to know something like this. Then you have an obligation. If he says to you specifically, "Do you know if he's a convert?" You don't have to volunteer information about, "Yes, he's a Baal Tshuva." Let's say, "Yes, you know a certain boy." "Yes, he's a Baal Tshuva." You have no right to offer that information. If he says to you specifically, "Is this person a Baal Tshuva?" Then you have to answer yes or no. Because obviously, whether right or wrong, that's a concern of his.
Can you ever offer it?
No, you cannot offer it unless you know for a fact that it's something that he's concerned about. But if you don't know that it's a concern of his, why should the first thing, "Do you know anything about that?" "Yes, he's a Baal Tshuva." So what, he's a Baal Tshuva? He should be proud for being a Baal Tshuva.
What happens if you have someone who's borderline interested, curious about, someone who's Jewish who's curious about Judaism? Do you have the right to reference Asher Wade as someone who has converted to Judaism if you're trying to encourage that person?
I don't think that Asher Wade should live and be well. I don't think that Asher Wade makes any secret about his background.
He doesn't make any secrets, but do I have the right to reference him as such?
Yes, if you need to reference him, Asher Wade certainly has no. And if anybody wants, if you know somebody doesn't mind being referred to as a Baal Tshuva, or somebody doesn't mind referring to as anything in their background, it doesn't have to be Baal Tshuva, anything in their background, same person as an ex-convict. Right, I'm proud of being an ex-convict. Right, I think I've turned over a new leaf. Right, I'm on the right path. Right? I'm an ex-convict. Right, if I'm proud of that, right, and you know that I'm proud of that, I'll be glad to talk to anybody who'd like to meet an ex-convict and pay to meet an ex-convict. Right, I'll be glad to talk to them. Then you can certainly refer to somebody in such a way. Aaron,
what's
tongue in cheek comment? What's tongue in cheek comment?
Let's say you see an acquaintance of yours and recently got married, and you know, he's with his wife, and you're like, "Oh, I see your wife's a good cook, you know. Maybe you put on a few pounds."
That's called an insult. Whether it's tongue-in-cheek. Now, it could be, the truth is, that the example you're using, because sometimes that could be the ultimate compliment for a new wife, is to say to her husband, you know. So that, then you have to, and then it's subjective on the individual. You know, you see the new husband. The question is, if you see a new, if you see a friend of yours who's recently gotten married and he's walking with his wife, and you say to him, "Maybe you ought to put another, loosen that belt up a little bit, right?" Or I see that your wife's a good cook, or something along those lines, making a reference to his midsection, right? So then, if depending on the people, remember, you have certain relationships with people where you're close enough that you can say something, what you call a tongue-in-cheek comment, right? So it depends how it's taken. If it's taken in... you can't trade off. It's not, you can't, I'm going to compliment his wife while I'm at him. I'm going to mop the floor with him. I mean, very serious. You can't do that. You can't, at the expense of him, give her a compliment. Okay, yeah.
What if you say something and you mean it as a compliment? You know, like you say that and you totally mean it as a compliment, and they didn't take it as such and you don't find out about it.
All right, you unintentionally hurt someone's feeling. Obviously, you're not to be blamed completely for it. It was certainly unintentional, right? We do have a. If you find out later that they hurt the feeling, certainly you apologize. You say, I really didn't mean it that way. But one does have an obligation to try to be careful. That's all. You know, one just has to try to be as careful as possible, right? Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. That's a very good question, because sometimes in the laws of Lashon Hara, which we're going to get to in a second, right, there's a question always, if you speak Lashon Hara about somebody, should you inform them? In order to apologize, should you inform them, right? If you walk over and say, you know, really, I'm really sorry, I told somebody you were a very big slob, right, and I really apologize for that, you know, it was really inappropriate. Then you're hurting them even more by letting them know. The only time you would have the obligation... The only time you'd have the obligation is if you've caused them a financial loss or a tangible loss, then you have to apologize. Then you have to let them know. Same thing by embarrassment. If you feel that by bringing up the subject again, right, by rehashing the old subject, you're going to cause them the same pain, then the halacha would be that you should better leave it alone. Better leave it alone. All right, let's go on to the next section. Now, the Chofetz Chaim, some of you may have heard of, some of you may not have heard of. His name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen. Right? He lived from 1938... From 1838 till 1933, Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, he was regarded as the unchallenged leader of Torah Jewry during his lifetime. The first major accomplishment of his life, he had many major accomplishments, one of them being the Mishnah Brura. Everybody's familiar with the Mishnah Brura commentary on Shulchan Aruch, which was written and compiled by the Chofetz Chaim. It took him over 25 years. The first major accomplishment of his life, the one that brought him the name, the Chofetz Chaim. Where does the name the Chofetz Chaim come from? So there's a verse that says, who is the man who desires life? Mi ha'isha Chofetz Chaim. Which man desires life? The man who desires life should guard his tongue, right? Oh, if yamim l'rotov, nitzor l'shom chamira. Guard your tongue from speaking evil. The Chofetz Chaim compiled all the laws of Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara literally means evil tongue. The laws of gossip and slander, the Chofetz Chaim compiled by going through the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, the Maimonides. He went through all of the sources where the laws were scattered about. He took the laws of improper speech, brought them all into one book, and he called this book Sefer Chofetz Chaim. Right? He published it anonymously. At the time, he was 35 years old. And the book was an immediate hit in the Torah community. Right? The Chofetz Chaim book spread in the Torah community. He was regarded as the expert on the laws of Lashon Hara. Just a little bit about the Chofetz Chaim, because there's somebody you're going to be hearing a lot more stories about. The stories about all children in the day schools, probably the one character who they hear most stories about, the one, and we always like the stories about somebody who is lived in a closer era, is much easier to relate to than stories from the Talmud or stories from the Bible. The Chofetz Chaim, there are countless stories circulating about the Chofetz Chaim. One of them was that he was called to court. One of his students, there were trumped up charges against one of his students in the Russian court. And the Chafetz Chaim was called as a character witness for his student. And when the Chafetz Chaim got up to testify, the prosecuting attorney, or the defending attorney, said to the judge, "Your Honor, do you know what they say about this man? Just so you should know what kind of man is standing in front of you. They say that one time a thief, a pickpocket, grabbed his wallet and started running away. And this man, the Chafetz Chaim, chased him down the street yelling, 'I forgive you! I forgive you!'" Right? That's the man who's standing in front of you. So the prosecutor looked at the judge and said, "Your Honor, you don't really believe that story, do you? You know, the ridiculous, you don't really believe that, do you?" The judge says, "Whether I believe it or not makes no difference. All I know is they don't tell stories like that about you or me." Right? That means where the story, where there's smoke, there's fire. Did it ever happen? I don't know if anybody grabs his watch. I don't know if the Chafetz Chaim was able to run when he was 90 years old, chase the thief down the street. But one thing we know about the Chafetz Chaim, they tell all these stories about him. You study his works. You study the ethical level, the ethical teachings that he taught in all of his works, in the Torah that he taught. Obviously, you're talking about a human being who reached a very high level of spiritual perfection. There's a story. He was once on a train. This is one of my favorite Chafetz Chaim stories. He was once on a train with Rabbi Meir Shapiro. Rabbi Meir Shapiro was the Rav of Lublin. They were on a train, and they were on the way to some type of rabbinic conference. And every stop where the train stopped, there were a lot of Jewish people at each little town they passed through. And everywhere the train stopped, the people were waiting at the train station on the platform to get a glimpse of the great Chafetz Chaim. He was a very old man at the time. He was close to 90 at the time. Rabbi Meir Shapiro was about 40, died when he was 45, so he's almost less than half the age of the Chafetz Chaim. You've heard of the Daf Hayomi, where they study one page a day? This Rabbi Meir Shapiro was the innovator of this Daf Hayomi, which has been completed. I think they're on the eighth cycle, that they've every 7 years they complete the entire Talmud studying a Daf a day. So this Rabbi Meir Shapiro was sitting there with the Chafetz Chaim. They kept passing through these little towns, and people were crowded on the platform trying to get a glimpse of the Chafetz Chaim. And Chafetz Chaim refused to leave. He refused to go out onto the platform to see the people because he felt, you know, what kind of arrogant behavior is it to stand there waving to God, "Here I am," everybody waving. And he felt that it's totally inappropriate. So Rabbi Meir Shapiro said to him, they finally got into the train, the train's moving, and Rabbi Meir Shapiro said to him, why don't you go out to greet the people? So the Chafetz Chaim said to him, "Well, you know, I don't wanna be arrogant." So Rabbi Meir Shapiro looked at him and said, "Well, what's wrong with arrogance?" Chafetz Chaim said, "What's wrong with arrogance? What's wrong with arrogance?" I'm sure in Yiddish it sounds better, right? Arrogance is a sin, right? So Rabbi Meir Shapiro looked at him and said, "Well, what's wrong with a sin?" Chafetz Chaim thought he was out of mind. "What's wrong with a sin? What's wrong with doing an Aveira? Are you kidding me? What's wrong with doing an Aveira? You burn eternally for doing an Aveira. What's wrong with an Aveira? God said not to do an Aveira. What do you mean, what's wrong with an Aveira?" So Rabbi Meir Shapiro said, "You mean because you're afraid of a little eternal burning, you're going to deny all those people on the platform their pleasure of seeing you?" Right? The next stop, the Chafetz Chaim got off the train and went out and he saw the people, right? And I guarantee you the Chafetz Chaim didn't burn for it. I guarantee you, right? The Chafetz Chaim was known for his love of his fellow Jews. He compiled these laws of Lashon Hara. Tomorrow we'll go into all the laws of what is permissible, what's not permissible. Just let me tell you one last thing about the Chafetz Chaim, very important to know. The reaction, when it comes to the laws of Lashon Hara, the reaction very often is, if I can't speak about people, what is there to speak about? What could I possibly speak about if I can't speak about people? After all, Lashon Hara makes the world go round, right? You know, the minute you speak to somebody, the minute they leave, then you talk about them behind their back. The Chafetz Chaim had a reputation of being a very talkative man. Right? By nature, he wasn't like that. He purposely turned himself into a very talkative individual in order to demonstrate to people that permissible speech, the fact that you're not allowed to talk about people, doesn't mean you don't have to talk. Right? So we'll see more about him tomorrow.